Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, writers from around the world discuss their journeys, finding community and creativity, and making a home in Chicago, presented by the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame. This conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hello, and welcome to our next program at the American Writers Festival. The Chicago Literary Hall of Fame recognizes local writers who have made significant contributions to literature and sponsors talks, social events, and tours that show off the city's literary lights. Our next program, presented by the Hall of Fame, highlights the immigrant stories that people brought to Chicago from elsewhere. Nestor Gomez is a storyteller and creator of 80 Minutes Around the World, a storytelling show that features the stories of immigrants, refugees, their descendants, and allies. Lonnie Montreal is a queer feminist Filipina writer, educator, performance activist based in Chicago, whose poems and essays have been anthologized in journals and books, and her plays produced in the Philippines, Canada, and the U.S. Ugoche Nwagugu is a multidisciplinary creative whose poems have been published in numerous anthologies, including The Golden Shovel, honoring Gwendolyn Brooks. The panel is moderated by Jane Hsu, professor of English at Dominican University, who specializes in teaching, researching Asian American and Latinx literatures and writing creative nonfiction. Welcome to you all.
Thank you so much, Carol. Thank you for arranging everything. Thanks to the American Writers Museum for this wonderful festival. Yes, I'm Jane Hsu, and I'm, in addition to being a professor of English at Dominican University in River Forest, I'm also a board member of the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame, and that, thank you. Hi, is that Carlos? Carlos Cumpion, board member, longtime Latino publisher and writer in Chicago. I thought that was you, Carlos, but you're hiding behind the hat. Barry Jung, who works at the Literary Hall of Fame, too. You see the luminaries around. And also Don Evans, who is the founder and director of the Literary Hall of Fame in the yellow, who is such an amazing supporter. And so I just encourage you to check out the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame, go to the website. We put on some great events. It's preserving and promoting the history of Chicago literature, and also great current and young and upcoming writers, including ones on this panel. Okay, so the format of this panel is, we've got a few like discussion questions with the writers, and then they will each be just reading a 5-minute excerpt from their work. Okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and we're gonna go, and then hopefully have a time for a question or two at the end. Okay, so the first question is, can each of you briefly describe your experience with immigration and how it affects your creative work? So I said briefly because obviously there's a lot, but however you want to gauge that, how does your experience with immigration affect your creative work? And anyone can go. We'll hear from all of you.
Okay. We're a bit hazy. We had a cast party last night. So.
Okay, so Lonnie, I don't know if people have heard, I don't think that was in the bio. She wrote this amazing play called Panther in the Sky. It closed last night. So yeah, she was at the after party, I'm
Forgive
sure.
Forgive me, guys.
She's on the move. Check out her stuff.
Thank you. Because
she does amazing thing, and she's super nice too, and she probably, you know, will blur her. But this play is about four young men, black, Latino, and Filipino, who were shot. I mean, it's based, maybe it's fictionalized, but based obviously on a reality in Chicago, who were shot and killed by peers or one by the police. And it's also about their four grieving mothers. And it was just amazing.
Thank you.
I was at it last night. I cried a lot, especially as a mom. So, but yeah, I'll let Lonnie answer the question.
I think, you know, well, my immigrant experience, very complicated, but it's, you know, it's very much, it's integral to all the writing that I do, whether it's poetry, it's plays, or essays. So, you know, it's always a journey. I always say that, you know, I write so I can create my home where I am. So that's my answer.
So. I will also say that the work that I write is from the perspective of an African woman living in America. So it's a very specific perspective because I feel like that is my lens. And so I approach the world in that way because that is the way I walk in the world. And that's the perspective that I have. I can't speak from any other person's perspective. So it's very, just like Lonnie says, it's very much a part of the work that I create.
Yeah, well, I tell personal narrative stories, which are stories about my life. So I came to this country undocumented at age 15. I couldn't speak the language. I used to stutter. And I found my creative outlet through storytelling. So all the stories that I tell about my personal life. So they, at first I didn't even realize they were immigration stories until I started telling them. But these things that happened to me, like I'm walking my dogs down the street, just like everybody does, and I'm speaking Spanish to my dog because I'm a Latino, my dogs are gonna speak Spanish. I'm just talking to my dogs in Spanish, a lady looks at me and says, like, this is America, you should speak English. Exactly, right? So just like that, it's a story that I tell, but it's just something that happens. It just happens to me, what happens to a person who speaks Spanish, who's an immigrant, who has to deal with all these microaggressions on a daily basis. So that, of course, my work reflects those experiences.
So on that note, we're going to have Nestor tell us a story.
So I was very excited because I was going back to Guatemala after many years. I have been in this country for 30 years, and I'm going back to Guatemala for the first time in many years. And I'm so excited because I remember Guatemala. I remember the open spaces, the fresh air, the quiet of the city. And I land at the airport. I go out of the airport, and I take an Uber because we do have Ubers in Guatemala. And as soon as I get on the Uber driver asks me, "So where are you from?" And I hate that he asked me this question. Because I have lived in the United States for 30 years. I'm a USA citizen now, but people will never see me as an American. People always ask me, "Where are you from?" And I'm back in Guatemala, my native country, and the first thing this guy is asking me is where I'm from. So I'm mad. But then I realize I'm coming from the airport. So he has no idea what country I'm coming from. So I calm down. I say, "Well, actually, I was born here, but I live in Chicago for many years." "Oh, so how's Chicago?" he asked me. And I say, "It's cold." "It's so cold, it reminds me of my ex-wife." But I'm so happy to be back in Guatemala and look at the open spaces and the fresh air and the quiet of the city. And he looks at me like I'm crazy. And when we get out of the airport and we start driving, I realize why he looked at me this way. You see, the open spaces of my childhood are no longer there. What I remember, open spaces, now there's a house and another house and a house and a house and a house. And the quiet of the city is not there anymore because there are so many cars. And I don't know if you know this, but in Guatemala, there are no tests for exhaust emissions. So every other car is leaving behind a cloud of smoke. I can barely breathe. I roll up the window of the car. I'm sneezing and coughing. And my people, we like to hear music loud. And I'm in a country full of people like me, so everybody's blasting their radios and they hung and they're like, "They're so loud, the quiet of the city is there no more. This is not the Guatemala of my childhood or my memories." I don't feel so good anymore. But then we get to the hotel, and it takes forever to get to the hotel. In my memories, it should take like an hour or two. It took us like 5 hours in bumper to bumper traffic to get to the hotel. We finally get to the hotel, and I feel better because now I'm going to Lake Atitlan, the most beautiful lake in the whole world. Sorry, Lake Michigan. I remember when I was about 12 years old, my mom took me and my siblings to Lake Atitlan. I didn't know this at the time, but we were saying goodbye to Guatemala because she was going to leave Guatemala. But she took us there, and it was my first time there. And I got in the water, and the water was up to my chest, which wasn't that high, because like 4 feet high. And I could see my toes. It was so clear and so clean that I took some water on my hands and it was delicious. Don't do that in Lake Michigan. So I did that in Lake Atitlan when I was a kid. So now I'm back. I want to do the same thing. And I get to Lake Atitlan and the water is murky. It kind of smells a little bit. I asked one of the people there that's taking selfies at the lake. I asked him, "What happened to the lake?" And he says, "Do you see the pipe? That's where the sewer used to come in." I'm like, it's not the same thing. It's not the Guatemala of my memories. Or maybe Guatemala hasn't changed, maybe I'm the one that changed because I've been living here in Chicago for so many years. Maybe I changed because I've been walking in Guatemala and now I'm tired of walking. I'm used to the CTA. I start to miss the CTA. I miss the smell of pee of the CTA and the trains. I miss it so much that a couple of days later, I'm back in the air and going back to the USA. And when I land in the USA and I get out of the plane and I'm at the terminal, I know I'm in the USA as soon as I see the people. Because in Guatemala, everybody was nice. Everybody say good morning to you. Everybody look at you in the eyes. Everybody talk to you. Here, everybody looking at the phones. People are walking around. People are pushing you out of the way. People are so rude. I miss that so much. And I feel so good to be back in the USA that I want to have a USA meal. So I go to a restaurant at the airport and I order a hamburger and fries and Coke. And I have my meal and I feel so good. And I get out of the restaurant and then I feel somebody touching me on my shoulder. And I look back and it's the waitress. You didn't pay for your meal, she say. So I show her my phone that I paid through the app. And she's like, no, 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 you didn't pay. She brings me back to the restaurant and she looks on the computer and she's like, oh yeah, yeah, you did pay for the meal. It's the new computer we have. She doesn't even apologize. I want to get into a fight with her. I want to scream at her, but I know better. So I just get out of there and I go sit at the terminal and I just sit there and I just want to go home. But where is home? Because I just came back from Guatemala where I was born, but I don't feel at home anymore. Everything is different. And I'm back in Chicago, but I don't feel at home in Chicago because this is my home, but people will never see me as an American. It's my first day back, and I already had to deal with microaggressions. And I know that people are trying to make this country better. I know that we're trying to make this country better, but I love this country so much. This is the country of my many firsts. The first time I make love to a woman. The first time I got married, the first time I got divorced, the second time I got divorced, I've been living the American life. I love this country so much. But like many people of color, I love this country so much and its promise of life, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness for everyone. But like every person of color, I just wish this country would love me back the same way. Thank you.
Thank you, Nestor. I love that. And my students, a Dominican to whom I have them watch Nestor's videos and have them inspire them to write their own and tell their own stories.
Love now it. You're going to make me cry because as a person that came to this country without a voice and to inspire other people to tell their own stories, that's like the best thing that could ever happen to me.
I'll tell my students you said that. You'll have to tell them yourself. Okay, so our second discussion question is, you may already get a sense from their bios and listening to Nestor's story, but these are what we call multi-genre, you know, artists. I mean, Nestor does storytelling. He's got a, you know, published book. Ugochi, you know, has a memoir. She's a musician. She's a wonderful singer. She's going to do a little singing in her piece. Lonnie wrote a play. She has a book of poetry called Fanboy. So if you can tell us what that stands for, then you're probably an English teacher like myself. I heard Lonnie sing once too, a little bit. That was great. So, you know, you all address themes of immigration across different genres. Did working in these, you know, certain forms and genres just come naturally to you? Like you want to express something, it comes out in a certain way, or, you know, and, you know, break down categories between that. But, or did you be like, oh, I want to write a poem about this specifically. Oh, I think I'll write a song or something.
Do you mind if I go first this time around? When it comes to naturally, people hear me tell stories and you're like, oh, you're a natural storyteller. I'm the farthest thing from a natural storyteller because I used to story when I was a kid. I didn't know the language when I came to this country. So even learning the language and learning to tell stories in English is difficult. But I used to write a lot because I couldn't talk. So I used to write a lot of poetry. A lot of bad poetry is what born out of my hand. But all those years of not being able to communicate myself actually taught me how to write properly or how to become a writer, because I just went to high school. I never went to college for a college degree or a writing degree or anything like that. But just through trying to communicate and trying to find a way to communicate and express myself, that's how I found my way into writing.
I I went to school for creative writing, but I found that poetry was how I could express what was on my soul. It was a way to be unedited and to be raw. And I find that when I'm trying to really get to the heart of a issue that is probably difficult to talk about, I find that music is the way that I can do that easier, because I think people are more receptive to hearing the messages in the music as opposed to me just saying it straight out on a poem, in a poem. Actually, with my book, I used my mom and my dad, and I used their words as prose. So whenever they're speaking in the book, it's prose, and then I am coming through as poetry. So it's really a lot of different styles mix for me, because I find that different mediums have different emotions for me personally. So yeah, it's always always a moving thing, you know. Sometimes a poem can do the trick, but sometimes it has to be a song. Sometimes it has to be a story, you know. So yeah, it's ever changing.
Yeah, I agree with you both, and you know, it's in a sense they come naturally, right? And they kind of stay with you, and you have to get it out. And so, you know, when you're an immigrant, when you're a foreigner in a country, what do you do? What's the first thing you do? You look for community, right? And so for me, I think that's how I was able to get into theater, because then that's where I found community. My I was gonna talk about how I wrote my first play in Canada, because that's the first. Well, I came here first, and then I crossed the border, so it's in my story. But yeah, so that's where I wrote my play, my first play, and that's because, you know, you have your community here. And then I ran away with the Circus, which is another theater group here in Chicago, which is they're called Cirque Up in Tig. And so again, it's for me, theater is just such a collaborative medium, and you get to tell the story collectively with, you know, with the actors, the directors. And so so in a sense, that's why I chose theater as my main medium. Of course, I've written my share of bad poetry. I think.
And good poetry.
I think, yeah. Yes, and good ones, yeah.
Share the poetry.
So, but yeah. Yeah, and also in between, like, you know, in between, like, being a mother and washing the dishes, grading papers, that's where you insert nuggets of poetry, right? And they just come to you. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we're going to hear a chapter of Ugochi's memoir, Seasons of Separation, called Igbo Lessons.
Yes.
And so I just want to say, too, that Igbo people, we talk in parables. It's a very, very story-driven kind of communication. If I asked my dad anything, he would start telling me parables. You're like, okay. So stories is just part of who we are. And when I write, I write in stories too. So this one is called Igbo Lessons. Igbo lessons never fail to chant my heartbeat tribal. Papa was bubbling optimism in full professor voice. This was the only time he would speak to us in fluent Ngwa Igbo until heads would subconsciously tilt left and right, looking like a tiny litter of confused dogs. Papa would belt hearty laughter like gospel. I imagine that's what Santa Claus must sound like. Then he would select special words for us to learn. Norodu maginti. Sit down and listen well, he'd say. Umu mutano iku Igbo. My children must learn to speak Igbo. So this is a little bit interactive, as is the way African people do. So I hope you're ready to learn some Igbo. Chineke. God. Mwa. Baby. Wanta moke.
Wanta moke.
Boy. Wanta wai.
Wanta wai.
Girl. Very good. It was only Chinyere, Mbuku, and me in these classes. My elder siblings, Adaku and Nnamdi, finally reunited with our parents in Chicago when they were 8 and 7 years old, respectively. They spoke no English. Adaku and Nnamdi were being held back in their grade level because they could not communicate effectively by American standards.
So on Prospect Street, communication was a cacophony of broken words melting into purpose movements. My parents decided to speak English exclusively to us so my older siblings could learn. It just stuck. I was born into an American vernacular. In fact, I spoke English so well that when I was 6 years old, my father told me and he sold me on my future occupation. I was to be a judge. It took me more than 10 years to realize I had to be a lawyer first. Nyem. Give me. Miri. Water. Aka. Hand. Isi. Head. Azu. Fish. Then, if we were lucky, he would dish some of the most appetizing childhood memories. I would savor the taste lingering on my tongue like a last meal. His stories were juicy morsels, sweet plantain offerings for my bottomless belly. I could not hear them enough. My favorite was when he would recount slavery and the war. We were the Nigerian family of refugees infiltrating Holy Name of Mary, all black, Catholic grammar school style. My fourth grade class had just begun learning about the North American slave trade. I was fascinated by the familiar feel of our kindred experience. My roots run deep, so deep, I sense my inner Kunta grapple Toby every day in personal battle. Nigeria is my direct homeland. I had no choice in our separation. Generations of my village ancestors first laid eyes on red earth. Mama and Papa were raised under the embrace of palm tree protection. Still, at times, I felt like more than a stranger to her. I am Cook County characterized, but within my parents' home is little Niger. It was Yankee rhetoric, adding salt to jollof rice. Rapa wrap torsos pounding yam around the clock, sometimes drowning in pepper soup and gari. I am a product of Umunkwo and Upakri. Without my people, America would just be a mirage. Yet I wrestled with the psychosomatic allure of blonde hair cascading down swarthy shoulders. On any given day, the likes of Silver Spoon, NBC News, and Michael J. Fox, with his family ties, deprogram my mind from the wisdom of the old ways back to the future. I was growing tired of the large serving of English Americana on our table. I wanted to live the untamed essence of Kunta Kinte, unafraid to face the public spectacle of shame and torture that is born with African pride. I vowed to never denounce my true name splattered on my spirit by blood-soaked bonds. Papa knew healing would come through self-awareness and acceptance. Papa would gravitate to the armchair that best comforted his fatigued bones, gather us up onto his rested lap like love, hold our gaze, and then he would sing. Oh, precious Lord, you see what white men have done. Oh, 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 precious Lord, you see what white men have done. Oh, when they first came here, they gave us looking glasses. Oh, oh, and they said to our boys, come go see something. Oh, oh, and when they came to the water, they said, come on, get on board, you African nigger. Get on board, you think I'm joking. Get on board. And so they rode away. Into the Mississippi they rode away. And they rode away. Into the Mississippi. When them sick, they threw them overboard. And they rode away. Into the Mississippi, they rode away. And they rode away.
into the Mississippi. Biko, please, Imela, thank you. Kedu, how are you? God Nudo, go in peace. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's...
He's like, I'm done. Bye.
Thank you so much, Ugoche. That was beautiful. Loved hearing that. Okay, so we just have one more question for everybody, and then we will hear from Lani. Okay, so this is the last question. And I think it links even with Ugochi's song about, I mean, obviously it's about immigration, but we also have, you know, forced migration, as in the African slave trade. So, you know, immigration is, you know, one of our most fraught political social issues, right? I think including, right, the migrants that have been bused from Texas and just dropped off on random corners in Chicago and the suburbs. But also, right, so one of the most fraught political issues and the most fraught personal issues, right, for immigrants and their loved ones and migrants. So how can writing and storytelling, and I guess other creative forms in general, art that you all do, but how does writing and storytelling help us cope, help us deal with immigration, whether it's, and could it even, you know, help or even improve our, you know, deep divisions over immigration politics or the challenges, you know, facing immigrants? But to also, you know, it's always like, it's so hard, right? Like, you know, life and death, but, you know, immigrants, migrants deserve to have joy and leisure, you know, and peace and as much as any of us, any human being, right? So what do you think?
I think it's a human right to have those things. And we all are from somewhere else. You know, if we actually trace all of our histories, very few, I mean, probably less than 10% of the people are actually from Chicago all the way down. So I just feel like everybody deserves that. And our stories are important to be told. Everyone has a story that speaks to their family, that speaks to their culture, that is rooted in who they are. And when we talk about different cultures, and you hear my dad, people used to always act like they couldn't understand what he was saying. And they would say, oh, you have your accent is so thick, like it was to be a point of shame. But the accent roots him to a culture. That's actually evidence that he has more than one language that he knows, and it's actually a whole culture behind that accent. So I think that I think storytelling is how we humanize some of these issues, because it's easy to just say, oh, these people came from wherever, and to disregard them. But we are all humans, and we all come from a place, and we all deserve to have certain rights. Now, having said that, I believe that these stories help us to enter people's worlds, you know, so that we can see who they are. And from there, we build our relationships. But I think the art is artists are better politicians than any politician could ever be, because of the way that we transgress all of that. And we go into culture, we go into people's problems and even our own problems to solve issues, where I feel like a lot of politicians get that messed up. So that's something that they could really learn from artists. It's how to be humans and how to deal with humanity.
Yeah, I will have to say that storytelling or the stories that we share help combat misinformation. Because we hear a lot of things about immigrants. Oh, they are a bunch of criminals. Oh, they are a bunch of lazy people. But we also hear a lot of things about people living in other states. Oh, there's a bunch of racist people living over there. So it's because we don't know each other, because we're here living our bubble, they're living in the bubble, but when we share these stories, we build bridges across communities, and we understand that our experiences are similar to their experience. We're all looking for the same things, life, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness.
And to add to that, I think they've pretty much covered everything, but, you know, any good story, you find commonalities with each other, and that's the way we are going to, I don't know. Like, for example, the play I just wrote, people just came out of there, like, talking to each other and just, you know, learning about each other's culture and identity, then that's a win for me. And yeah, so that's how I think that storytelling is very important. And as an educator too, we encourage our students to tell their stories, because if you don't, somebody else will tell it, right?
Okay, so now we're gonna hear from Lonnie.
Yay!
So like Jane said earlier, this piece is an excerpt from a longer piece, which is going to be featured at the Links Hall, so I hope you guys can come check it out. It's called Anak ni Tapia, and I do have flyers here so you can take them with you. And Anak ni Tapia just means child of Tapia. I grew up in the Philippines with a celebrity mother who played a character for over 15 years. So it's called Anak ni Tapia, Leaving Mother, Living in the Shadow of an Icon. I leave, that's what I do. Even my partner knows I probably won't stay if I can't leave every now and then. When I was little, my grandfather would take me on these endless bus rides. I remember how comforting, as if I was being cradled and rocked gently, sweetly by invisible arms. I was not the kid who asked if we were there yet. I think I never did want to get there, wherever there may be. I only wanted to stay where I was, seated on the bench with vinyl cushions, leaning against a wooden back, watching the sun slowly paint the sky red from behind the mountains, or the trees, the rice fields glowing, the vendors at every stop hawking food and souvenirs, a keychain, a toy with moving parts, rice cakes, buko pai. This may be why I'm so comfortable where I am, in the gap between here and there. My sister nicknamed me Darna, the Philippine Wonder Woman, not because I was heroic, but because I liked to fly, although back home I mostly took buses and boats. My friends call me Kaladkarin, one you can drag with you to go anywhere, gypsy girl with no roots, constantly moving. In college, I went on these immersion programs where I stayed in the mountains with indigenous folks at one time, and then by the ocean with fisher folk. Another year, it was with farmers in the countryside. What a way to learn that the world did not revolve around me and my petty bourgeois angst. At some point, my mom and big sister got used to my leaving, that they stopped worrying and assumed I was just at a friend's house or later on somewhere on an island chasing after a story or a celebrity for the magazine. Once, it dawned on me that I could disappear from the face of the earth, lost forever, and everyone would just assume that I was somewhere, biding my time, doing what it was that I did. I was off the grid, even before that became a thing. When I left for the U.S., I did not think I would stay, but then I crossed the border to Canada, where I fell in love with an old high school friend and decided to try it out. Try living in this stolen land, so vast and so white. Ah, the things we do for love. In Toronto, I embraced my queerness. I had never felt so proud to be who I am, loving who I love. I met a group of young, fearless Filipino-Canadians who taught me, hey, hey, ho, ho, homophobia has got to go. 2 years later, while working for a community organization that advocated for the rights of vulnerable Filipinos in Canada, including LGBTQ, I was commissioned to write my first play. It was the mid-90s, at the height of the AIDS crisis, and our ED thought it would be a good idea, since I'm a writer, to use theater as a way to educate and raise awareness. Never mind that the only play I wrote was in high school, and it was a plagiarized English version of my sister's play. Filipino Canadians were the hardest hit by AIDS-related deaths in the Asian community. There was a story of a young Filipino man who died in hospice care alone because his family disowned him. Can you write a play about a grandmother and a gay grandson who's got AIDS? That was my assignment. Si Apo at ako, my grandmother and I, came to be a dramedy, which is like a drama comedy with a cast of thousands, about the ghost of a young man who appears only to his quirky grandmother. She helps his spirit move on by bringing the community together to rally behind afflicted kababayans. Time to cast the play. Why don't you ask your mom to play the lead character? Are you insane? I didn't exactly say that to my boss, but in my head I did.
My mom's a born-again Christian. She's not going to do it. At the time my mother was in between gigs, she asked me to send the script, and to my surprise, she said yes. She flew to Toronto the following month. The production ran for 2 weekends. Filipino Canadians came in droves to watch, and they gave her a standing ovation each time. Even the mayor of Toronto came out to see her. The play did bring people together. There's a precious picture with all the cast members and volunteers, some with HIV and AIDS, mostly queer or queer-friendly. Everybody in their best holiday attires, faces made, smiles twinkling, and there, standing proudly among them, my supposedly homophobic mother. Thank you.
Okay, well, we're at time. So thank you all for coming today, and thanks to all these wonderful writers and storytellers.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.